are blessed to have the association of all of you once again. Thank you for your eagerness to chant the glories of the Lord, your enthusiasm to hear, and your compassion on all souls. This is a particular topic, or we could just talk previously. Disappearance of the Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And I read the transcript of a lecture that Srila Prabhupada gave in 1969 on that topic. Beautiful lecture. In Srila Prabhupada's typical, very simple, very clear, very convincing, pertinent and structured form. He began by explaining that the benediction given by the sage who blessed four different individuals with a blessing just appropriate to each, to the prince, he gave the blessing, don't die, just live forever. To the brahmachari, he blessed, don't live, die now. To the sadhu, the saintly person, just completely dedicated to Krishna's service, whatever that may entail, he said, you can either live or die. And to the butcher, don't live, don't die. Then Srila Prabhupada explained, prince is enjoying this world like anything. Full facility for sense enjoyment, which is utilizing enthusiastically. Don't die. Because whatever you enjoy in this world, that enjoyment is sowing the seeds for your suffering. And the suffering is, according to one angle of vision, equal to the enjoyment. Because as much as you enjoy anything temporary, you suffer to that same degree when you lose it. You actually suffer more. Because between the time that you think you're enjoying and the time you find you're suffering, you're in anxiety because you know it's going to end. So for one, fully dedicated and absorbed in enjoying this world, don't die. Because it's going to be very miserable. Of course, everybody dies. So the benediction is made that it was meant to make us contemplate these matters. To the brahmachari, who's performing such tapasya, undergoing such suffering, to attain perfection in spiritual life, don't live. Die now, and reap the rewards of your tapasya. Go back home, back to Godhead. To the sadhu, who's perfectly Krishna conscious, either live or die. You're absorbed in the service of the Lord on the transcendental platform. It makes no difference if you're living or if you go elsewhere to continue your service. It's all blessed. To the butcher, whose life means giving pain to others, don't live. Nothing but horrible, ghastly pain. And don't die. Because then, all the suffering that you could be inflicted on others will come back to you. Don't live, don't die. Srila Prabhupada introduced his lecture with this story to explain the glories of his own spiritual master. He said, today, we're honoring his disappearance. But whether appearance or disappearance for the devotee, it's all service. It's all in the absolute platform. And then he told something about his life, beginning with his childhood, how he stole a mango meant for the deity before it was offered. And his father chastised him mildly. He's a young child, 2 or 3 years old. When his father explained to him that that mango was meant to be offered to the deity, he shouldn't have taken it before it was offered. His 2-year-old child said, what wicked thoughts have overcome me. For this, I will never again take a mango. Srila Prabhupada said, this is an example of determination. He had to, and he stuck to that, he stuck to that vow of his life, because in India, it's customary that you give mangoes as gifts to sadhus, especially in the summer season. The mango is very cooling, very pleasing. A worthy gift to a sadhu, but he'd always reach, I can't take, I'm an offender. And then she, you know, she told various episodes from his life, how the, you know, he was born with the umbilical cord around like a robin thread, you know, when his mother put him up on Jagannath's cart, garland fell down, this blessing. But he was emphasizing, he undertook so much tapasya to inaugurate this movement. Why? Because everybody in this world is suffering. And people try to address the suffering on different levels. And therefore, on one level, people are inspired to perform philanthropic work to help others. The Srila Prabhupada gave the analogy that if a boy is starving in the streets and you give him something to eat, that's good. But if you have more understanding and realization of the matter, and you know that boy is the son of a very wealthy man, and he forgot it, then you tell him, my dear, such and such, you are the son of a very wealthy man. What are you doing loitering in the streets, suffering for want of the basic necessities of life? You turn to your father, and all your problems are solved. So true compassion means to, you know, we see living entities in this world are suffering. Even if they think they're enjoying, they're planting the seeds for future suffering by that very act. So what do? Try to give them some pleasure? Try to give them some relief? Yes, we do that. But not so much that that's how we show our goodwill. That's how we show our friendship, kindness, concern. The real compassion is to tell your brothers and sisters, you're the children of the most wealthy person. If you return to him, all your problems are solved. And then Srila Prabhupada concluded his lecture by saying, I'm an old man, I can go away at any time. But you're young. Push on this moment. And then he told about the last letter he wrote to his Guru Maharaj just before he departed this world. How can I serve you? And wrote back, push on this movement, the English-speaking world. That'll do good to them. That'll do good to you. Srila Prabhupada explained the nature of material life in a very plain and simple, straightforward manner. Our material life is based on envy of Krishna. Lord Krishna wants to share all his love, all his opulence, his own ecstasy with all his parts and parcels. We all seek unlimited pleasure and will always be frustrated and disappointed in the material world because everything here is temporary and limited. Our desire for pleasure is eternal and unlimited. Cannot be satisfied or fulfilled in material pursuits and material relationships. It can only be fulfilled in turning back to Krishna. Where did the problem start? Srila Prabhupada told a very simple story, the story of a dog. And you know, dogs somehow, by the relative nature of material illusion, think that a bone is the most precious treasure. You know, what is this disgusting to us? You know, the most enduring piece of a corpse. I just want to get rid of it and get away from it. Just have it disappear. And the dog brings it right to you. It's just offering. You know, Bhagavad Gita says, what is daytime to the conditioned soul is night to the sage, because, you know, conditioned souls, they're very alert and attentive and awake to sense gratification. And to devotees, they're just asleep to that. They just don't want it. But devotees are very alert and eager for humble service. Sense gratification, not interested. But the dog, that is his most precious treasure. And they'll just like lock it in their teeth. If somebody tries to take it away, they'll fight for it. So this dog is proudly clutching his bone in his teeth, and came to a small river. He looked in the river and he saw a dog with a bone. And that bone was better than his bone. And he told himself, I have to have that bone. So he lunged to grab the bone away from the other dog. And you know the sound of him going into the river? It sounded like bloop. And he lost his bone, and he never got the other bone. And it's a simple story, and something you might see any day. It's very instructive. You know, you may have something, and somebody else has something of equal value, but there's something about that. It's just more attractive than what you have. And we're not only talking about gross physical possessions. We're also talking about gifts of, you know, artistic abilities to be able to, you know, paint beautiful illustrations or play nice music or tell enchanting stories or good work, whatever. If you're so preoccupied with, I want your gift, then you miss your own. Because everybody has a gift. They have a calling given by Krishna to offer back to him. But what does Krishna mean? He's the proprietor, the controller, the enjoyer of everything. He's Amaram. He's fully self-satisfied eternally. What does he need our little offerings of fruit, flour, a cup of water? But the deity actually becomes thirsty for our cup of water. He's wanting these flowers that we are. Now, the simple, like Radhisham and Gopal, they usually at home, they eat off leaf plates because we can't afford things like paper plates. And but Tahiti, and you know, Pujari is over, you know, years and decades of service, they get to sense what the deity is feeling and wanting. And yeah. But what does he need of our offerings? He doesn't need. He wants. He becomes hungry for our food, thirsty for our water, yearning for our love. For our sake. Why is he eager for our offerings? Because by offering our gifts, whether emotional or artistical or physical or whatever, he accepts, if offered with love and devotion and humility. And when he accepts and we feel that reciprocation of love, everything and anything in this world becomes just irrelevant, and they understand what Krishna means. That the sage is asleep to what others are awake to, since the humble service to which the devotees are very alert and eager, Krishna souls are asleep, they're not interested. So, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, we have, you know, many examples of how envy is so destructive to relationships. Daksha, this great Prajapati, you know, so, he's like, you know, all the demigods and fire gods and sages and universal administrators. Everybody, when he walked into the sacrificial arena, they all stood up and showed their respects. Everybody but Lord Shiva, who, because he was immersed in contemplating the sweetness of Krishna's love, didn't even notice what was going on. The great Daksha had entered. And Daksha began to speak. In this assembly of cultured and learned persons, to see the behavior of this Shiva, who is inferior to me. He's my son-in-law. And he didn't show respect. And Daksha was so offended. Because to the conditioned soul, the king of all enjoyments is sex pleasure, of which prestige is a subtle form. And Krishna says that for one who has been honored, dishonor is worse than death to the false ego. And Daksha explained that, I'm not speaking out of envy. And usually when somebody says that, you know what platform they're coming from. I'm not speaking out of envy. But, you know, he was thinking it's his duty to educate everyone on proper Vaishnava etiquette. And then when Lord Shiva, you know, came out of his trance and realized what was going on, he was, you know, sorry. He wasn't offended. He was Daksha's well-wisher. Daksha's son-in-law. Which is inferior from a family perspective, but from a devotional perspective, you know, Lord Shiva is the highest amongst beings in this world. But Daksha was seeing things from a material perspective, which is where envy is born. Envy is born of pride. When you think that what you do is your ability, what you make is your creation, what you do is your under your control, become attached because you want to enjoy. If you're the doer, then you take the credit and you want to enjoy what you do. Enjoy who you are. The problem is that mentality breeds competition. Because when you have unlimited conditioned souls in the same world who all want to enjoy and control limited resources, there's competition. And that competition creates conflict. And when the conflict is fueled by some controversy and fanned by the winds of whatever time, it blazes forth as samsara, samsara dava nalita loka anayakari nakanakanata. And it is the spiritual master who extinguishes this blazing fire of material existence, born of our desire to enjoy, exploit, control, which leads to conflict and competition, which burns the spirit, which seeks the sweetness, which is the taste of harmony, and the camaraderie born of loving relationships. I mean, even in this world, men become very attached to warfare. Ghastly activity. Everybody blowing each other up. But they become attached to that. For different reasons. One reason is the sense of camaraderie. When they see, we're really dependent on each other. If we don't stick together and work together, we're finished. Usually finished anyway because nobody really wins, but that sense of teamwork, camaraderie is so attractive that people will risk their lives for it. But that's a perverted reflection because it should not take such a ghastly means to realize your dependence on others. The fact is, we are dependent. Krishna is the only Purusha, the only real enjoyer. Everyone else is Prakriti. We are, by constitutional nature, designed to be enjoyed by Krishna. He is the only enjoyer. When we try to usurp his position artificially, then your own consciousness removes you from the Ladini Shakti, which is personification of bliss, and places you in the Antaranga Shakti, which is marginal. It's full of suffering and competition. Krishna is forever inviting all conditioned souls to return home and share in his enjoyment. All his opulence, all his love, all his ecstasy, he is eager to share with all his parts and parcels. But that dog has a bone that's better than mine. I must have it. Then he loses his own. And he ends up being swept away in the currents of the river, where he attacked the other dog, who is his own self, reflection of his own self. That's why Vinamoga, the son-in-law of Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, was devising means to find some fault, to blaspheme Lord Chaitanya, and he, by his own consciousness, which was infected with envy, contracted cholera. Lord Chaitanya was very disturbed to hear this. And he came to him, put his hands on his chest. Amoga, why have you become envious of your own self? Consider that. Envy means we're envious of our own self, like that dog looking at the other dog with the better bone. Who's he really envious of? He's envious of himself because he's envious of Krishna. If you're envious of Krishna, you have inherent envy of all living entities. And conversely, if you have love for Krishna, you have natural love for all living entities, which will reveal itself in compassion, wanting to help mitigate their sufferings with knowledge. Why are you suffering such poverty, such scarcity? You're the child of the most wealthy person. So, when Lord Shiva was so insulted by Daksha, it didn't bother him, because Vaishnava is humble. They don't take insults to themselves. But he was sorry for Daksha, his disease. But at his residence, when his wife Sati saw the beautiful celestial airplanes, powered by mantra, beautiful hymns. What power is the spacecraft on your planet? On Earth, they use jet fuel for kerosene, but the celestial aircraft, they're powered by mantra. You know, those who are learned in the spiritual science of sound can extract tremendous power from within the mantras to power their airplanes from planet to planet. It's fragrant like lotuses. And these beautiful demigods and goddesses, beautiful physical characteristics because they have devotion. Sati was seeing they're going to her father's sacrifice. She knew her family would be there, a big social occasion. She wanted to go, and Lord Shiva told her, you will not be respected, honored, or welcome because of your bodily relationship to me. He'll offend you, he'll insult you. But she was too attached. She went. Brahma and Vishnu did not attend the sacrifice because they knew it would be disastrous. Because sacrifice means to make sacred by dedicating to Krishna everything, all our thoughts, words, deeds, relationships, possessions, everything, life. So Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva did not attend. Sati was insulted, dishonored, disgraced by her own father. Just hideous. It's the nature of this enemy. That even the most dear relationships, when they no longer give us pleasure, we can't stand the person. This is a duality, this attachment and aversion are just the opposite sides of the same coin, envy. And therefore, Krishna says, we must follow the negative principles of freedom by which we can rise above such dualities and attain the causeless mercy of the Lord. by which we see everything with equal vision. Everyone is part and parcel of Krishna. So Sati was insulted by her own father. It was so painful to her. She invoked the fiery element within her by yogic abilities, consumed herself in the fire, and did the sacrifice. And Lord Shiva, who was not insulted by offenses to him, took action when his dear devotee Sati was so insulted, created that monster, Virabhadra, to wreak havoc in the assembly. Took Daksha, placed his head on the chopping block meant for the sacrificial animal, cut off his head. But the priest in that sacrifice had sufficient yogic ability to rejoin his head. So he threw his head in the fire, the south side of the sacrificial fire to be consumed by the flames. There'll be no chance of putting that head back to his body. And just havoc in the sacrifice. And then later, Lord Shiva gave, because the chopping block was meant for sacrificing goats. So they gave Daksha the head of a goat. That was Lord Shiva's compassion towards his father-in-law. This would be the best thing for him. Because every time he looks in the mirror, he realizes, I don't have anything to be proud of. Because even in animal culture, a goat is not really the most honored species. So, and then we have the sacrifice of Maharaj Pritha, who wanted to perform 100 horse sacrifices for the pleasure of Lord Vishnu. Now, for those who don't understand the science, you know, when an animal is offered the sacrifice, an old animal, benefited. It attains a youthful, better form, or it goes back to Godhead. So it's beneficial to the animal. So Pritha Maharaj wanted to perform 100 ashwamedhas, but one can attain the post of Indra by such an achievement. So after 99 sacrifices, Indra appeared in different forms as different, you know, sannyasis to steal the sacrificial offering time and time again. Vijayatatra wanted to, you know, kill him, but Pritha Maharaj just let him go. The Lord Vishnu himself appeared in Pritha Maharaj's sacrificial fire because he was so pleased by his humility, his dedication, his cooperation. But Indra was envious because Pritha Maharaj is about to equal him in his achievement. So Pritha Maharaj kept, you know, trying to make the 100th offering. Indra kept assuming forms of different sannyasis so he wouldn't be killed. It was just, you know, havoc. Finally, Lord Brahma appeared and told Pritha Maharaj that Indra, this, you know, you can't handle that, you're going to equal or surpass him. You just can't handle it. So just be satisfied with a lesser achievement. So Pritha Maharaj accepted relinquished his ambition to perform Hridayashtami yajnas. Because the higher principle in any spiritual achievement is cooperation. It's the harmony amongst the Vaishnavas. Because wherever there's envy, Krishna will not be pleased. We all have it within us. If you're trying to subdue it, you have that integrity that you admit, yes, I have envy in my heart. I don't want it. I've been given a process to subdue it. I follow it sincerely. And you're given credit as being a devotee. Where there's cooperation, there's harmony. We've discussed many times the synergy effect. Say an herbal formula, you combine valerian, passiflora, skullcap, hops, and you get a remedy that has more potency than all those ingredients' effects added together. Or, as a teamster, I say you take one draft horse, it's 1 horsepower, hitch him to another draft horse. From one perspective, that's 2 horsepower. You end up with 7 horsepower. Where all the extra power come from? You can call it team spirit, or whatever you want, but it's Krishna. With his That's if it's actually a team and they work well together. If they fight, then you don't get anything. But it's Krishna. He's attracted by cooperation, by harmony, by trust, which leads to love, if cultured and protected and nurtured. So the principle of sacrifice is to please Krishna. Bali Maharaj, grandson of Prahlad, is performing a sacrifice to please Lord Vishnu under the guidance of his spiritual master, Shukracharya. Very powerful sage. Bali Maharaj was previously fighting on behalf of the demons. He was killed in the battle. But Shukracharya brought him back to life along with his commanders and infused them with such shakti that the demons actually overpowered the demigods and took over the whole universe, usurped even the throne of Indra, conquered even Indra. But the nature of material desire is the more you get, the more you want. It's never satisfied. Krishna says it's like you're pouring ghee on a fire. The more you ghee, the more the fire rages. It's not satisfied with ghee. It just wants more and more. So in Hiranyakashipu is a classic example. He conquered the whole universe. Even sages such as Narada were bowing down before him. Was he satisfied? He was more agitated than ever. More dissatisfied. The more he achieved. So, Bali Maharaj performing a sacrifice to please Lord Vishnu. Attracted by the sacrifice comes Brahmana, the dwarf Brahmana. And he asked for some charity. And Bali Maharaj said, I'll give you whatever you want. Shukracharya said, no, this dwarf Brahmana is Vishnu. Don't. But he already offered to give him whatever he wanted. He said, but a promise can be broken under certain conditions, like if it's really going to jeopardize your life. He was very learned.
And it will jeopardize. He's Vishnu. He'll take away everything.
So Bali Maharaj is being informed by Shukracharya that this is Vishnu. He'll take away everything. Don't give him what he wants. But he's performing the sacrifice to please Vishnu. Vishnu has come. He's telling me that. No. He'll take everything. What he really meant is, you know, my bhakshim is dependent on your, and if he takes everything away, then where's my income? But he didn't say that, of course. But Bali Maharaj wasn't concerned that after, you know, conquering the universe, he was going to lose it all, because he was devotional. Even though he was fighting him on behalf of the demons, he was a devotee, ultimately. But Shukracharya made it clear, I order you not to give him what he wants. In other words, he was invoking the curse of his guru. And Shukracharya, you know, if he can bring Bali and all his commanders back to life after they've been killed in battle, you see what kind of potency he has. Would you incur his wrath just to fulfill a promise to someone who's going to take everything away from you? But he was, I'm the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj. And with that lineage, he could not, you know, forfeit the integrity of that line by breaking his promise. So he incurred the curse of his guru, which was appropriate because he wasn't giving proper guidance. So he rejected him and incurred his curse. Vamana took everything with two steps, which, you know, covered the whole universe. Where do I put my third? On my head, my lord. Atma Nivedana. Surrender yourself. So, in this age, the Lord appears in Navadvipa, which means nine islands. In the Lord Gauranga appeared in Navadvipa. Nine islands floating in the Ganges, like a lotus, with eight petals, which are eight islands, and another island in the middle, which is the stamen. Each island represents one aspect of devotional service, shravanam, kirtanam, smaranam, archanam. Shravanam, kirtanam, smaranam, madhasevanam, archanam, madhanam, dasyam, sakyam. And then in the center, the ninth island, atmanivedanam. Surrender of the soul, that's where the Lord appears. Mayapur, that's where he appeared in this world. And why did he appear? It's predicted. Krishna varnam prasa krishnam sangopanga shaparsanam yagyai sankirtana priyayatantihi samedasa. Those who were so fortunate as to appreciate the very essence will perform the sacrifice of chanting the holy names of the Lord, as propagated by the Lord himself in the poem Sri Siddhartha. It's very interesting. At the end of Bali Maharaj's sacrifice, in Vamana, you know, you couldn't fulfill your promise to give me whatever I asked. You know, with two steps I've covered everything. What else? For the third, I asked for three footsteps. Where to put the third? So he punished him, he bound him up, he humiliated him before his family members. But he accepted his proposal, he put his third step upon my head. And Lord Vishnu, Vamana, was so pleased, accepting the offering of his heart in love and devotion and humility. And Krishna assures us, if we dedicate ourselves to this path, he will preserve whatever we have and carry whatever we lack to ensure that we go forward and never fall back. So Bali Maharaj was in a terrible predicament. He lost everything. He was humiliated before his family members and ministers and citizens and everyone. He couldn't fulfill his promise. And he was cursed by his guru. So materially, it was a disaster. And that's what Govardhan Leela is all about. Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill to protect the Brijavasis, because the Indra Yagi means the utilitarian principle of doing whatever is best for the upliftment and well-being and protection and security of society. Which is alright, as long as it doesn't conflict with the devotional principles. And if for the sake of pleasing Krishna, we have to risk everything and incur possibly the destruction of the universe, which was imminent with the Vrijavasis stopping the sacrifice of Indra. No harm can befall a devotee if for the sake of pleasing Krishna the whole universe is destroyed, because Krishna protects. That's what Yuri is telling us here. Take shelter under a Govardhan Hill. Nothing can harm you. Just to make sure that everybody believes, you declared Arjuna boldly that my devotee never perishes. So at the end of the sacrifice, when Bali Maharaj was in so much trouble, Vamana turned to Shukracharya and said, if there is any discrepancies in the sacrifice, please, you and your host of Brahmanas in the line of Bhriga Muni, either, you know, correct the discrepancies, or tell us what to do to correct any flaws in the performance, in the sacrifice of Bali Maharaj. And what did Shukracharya say? My Lord, the neighbor's constant chanting of your holy names, all discrepancies are rectified. This is in the previous age, when sacrifice was the method of self-realization. We perform sacrifices in this Kali Yuga, fire sacrifice. It really has, you know, no merit of its own. But it helps. To remind us to take our vows seriously. So we have the yajna, the fire sacrifice, which is the yuga dharma of the Treta Yuga. We have meditation, which is the yuga dharma of the Satya Yuga. And deity worship, which is the yuga dharma of the Dvapara age. But who can perform any of these activities in the Iron Age without all kinds of discrepancies? Therefore we chant the holy name in everything we do. Krishna Varam Prasad Krishna Sankopanga Saparasaram Yagyai Sankirtanayam Itanti Hisa Megasa. In the age of Kali, intelligent persons, not material intelligence, Sumedasaha, those blessed with such discrimination to appreciate the very essence of good things, will take to the Sankirtan movement with faith that by chanting the holy names of the Lord, one can transcend all the anomalies of the Kali Yuga and attain the real treasure of our hearts, which is love for Krishna. That love, which Lord Gauranga is distributing in the form of the chanting of the holy name, is the only antidote to the envious nature which attracted the dog into the reflection, creating a sound like whoop as he entered into the material pool. The Lord Garanga has come and is calling Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago, Goda Chanda Bole, Kota Nida Dayavaya, Vishachina Kole. When the eastern horizon is first tinged saffron, indicating the coming of the dawn, Lord Garanga, dancing through the streets of Dahya with his associates, is calling, come living entities of the Kali Yuga. You're seeking happiness of the body and mind, which produces only misery. You are seeking unlimited ecstasy, and I am offering that to you if you simply chant the names of Garanga, or I think another would say, chant the names of Garanga. Asha Garanga Kaha Garanga Laha Garanga. And I will be your servant. This is the humility of the Lord. So in this world, we'll be insulted and neglected and betrayed. But it has nothing to do with your soul. It's just the body, which is just a reflection. The reality is, Jivara Swarupai, Krishna Vinitadas. We're part and parcel of Krishna. The three cardinal truths which Lord Garanga and his associates have taught is sambandha, proper relationship to the environment, meaning that Jivara Swarupai, Krishna Vinitadas, we're part and parcel of Krishna. In this world, relationships are inspired by Cupid, which means lust, which culminates in envy, and conflict, and disappointment, and frustration, and pain. And it all ends. Madan, with his arrows, cites lust in the hearts of living entities. They just become mad at the bodies of others to enjoy and exploit and control. So, therefore, the deity of Sambandha is Madan Mohan. He who enchants even Cupid, what to speak of everybody else, of whom the Acharya is Raghunath. I mean, Rupa Goswami. And then when you understand your proper relationship to the environment, Jivara Swarupai Krishna, I'm eternal servant of Krishna. I'm not the servant of these illusional souls who are attracting me by the influence of Cupid. I'm the servant of Krishna. Which means you are servant to the others if you understand that your proper relationship is sambandha. That truth leads to abhideya, devotional service, which is the path to success, of which the deity is Govinda, who attracts and satisfies the mind and the senses and the heart. Attracted by him on the path of devotion, fulfillment comes from Gopinath with Prayojana, pure love of God, which Raghunath Das Goswami is the Acharya. So, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, toward the end of his leela, was saying there's not much time left. Worship Krishna with your heart and soul. Many people have been disturbed by my preaching strongly the truth. but it's only for their welfare, and someday they'll realize that and appreciate it. Like an old cow who's benefited by being offered up in sacrifice, let this body be offered up in the sacrifice of the holy names. And our aspiration is to be a speck of dust to fill history to share with God. Isn't this just enticing to the false ego? It wants to be the Lord and Master, Enjoyer, and Controller of everything. And our aspiration, the reason of all our tapasya, our sacrifice, our austerities, our discipline, is to become a speck of dust. And Srila Prabhupada also said the same thing. Our aspiration is to be a speck of, but he said Rupa Raghunath. Because our position is servant, and our masters are most loving, and our guardians are watching over, protecting, and encouraging, and facilitating through all the insults, and all the pleasures, and everything of this world. They're arranging opportunities so we can work out our karmas, pay off our debts, and graduate from the school of life. Of course, I know this is very arrogant for an illiterate farm boy to be talking to pundits in the Scholastic Emporium of State College, telling you that there's another exam in the School of Life, which I urge you to pass. It's called death. Every rising and setting of the sun in this world diminishes the life of materialistic persons, but for the devotees of the Lord, it's one day nearer. So there's the land of the living, calling us home, and there's the land of the dead. And there's a bridge between the two. It's devotional service. So if we want to do good to ourselves and to others, remind each other, not once, continually. Work together to make, to offer this life, offer this sacrifice for the pleasure of Krishna, to cure the envy which hurled us down into this reflection, because we thought that treasure that that other person had was better than what we've got. We lost our own treasure in the process, but we can have it back if we just give up that envious mentality. But you can't. It's too powerful. Born a false ego. Nobody in this world can conquer him. But Krishna can. The personification of envy in this world is Kaliya, the serpent. The part of the human body that's most like a serpent is the tongue. So inclined to spontaneously spout its venom at the faults in others, which shows how much greater I am. And I'm not speaking out of envy. It's my service to point out your faults because I can see them. It doesn't mean you're great because you can see the faults in others. So, of all the senses, the tongue is the most voracious and difficult to control. But Krishna has given us this nice prasadam and the holy name. Keep Krishna dancing on your tongue as he was dancing on the hoods of Kaliya. And all the poison will be eventually extracted. And when it's all gone, there's nothing left but pure love of God. And in that loving relationship with God, he is, or we are able to share all his ecstasies, all his pleasures. by serving him as a speck of dust at the lotus feet of Sri Rupa and Sri Raghunath, to which our connection is the Gurudev, which they have sent to rescue us and train us and guide us and lead us back to home. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Hare Krishna.
I have two questions. One was related to the story you mentioning of Hari Maharaj.
About?
Hari Maharaj.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't even understand. In that story, there is this person called Shukracharya.
Yeah, his family priest, his priest.
He mentioned that he had the power to even bring people back to life. So, if that was the case, why was he concerned about his income? Why was he so not ready to let Hari Maharaj just go ahead and give up the thing?
Because however powerful you are with yogic abilities or mystic powers or anything else, if you still have envy in your heart, you're going to be fearful. He had the power to bring others back to life. Not only bring them back to life, but invest them with new life and new vigor to conquer over the enemies who killed them in the first place. He did that with Bali and his generals. He had that tremendous mystic power. But he wasn't a pure devotee. He still had some teams of envy. When Lord Vishnu came, he said, don't give him what he asks. He still had envy. So, that's why Apostle Paul, in Western tradition, in Christian theology, anyway, the verses of Paul. Interesting personality. He was a Pharisee, which is a smarta in the West. Pharisee. Who thought that these Christians were heretics. He was very dedicated to persecuting Christians. But in Jerusalem. But then he told his authorities, you know, I want to go to this, what's the town? I forget the town, but it was a trading town where, you know, caravans came from all over and traded. The Christians are there, and from there, the message of Jesus is going to go around the world, so I will go there and exterminate these Christians. So on the way, there's the, you know, a flash of light that blinded him, and he fell off his horse. He was blind. And then a voice told him, if you want to get your sight back, go and surrender to this particular person in that town. I was a Christian. So he went and humbled himself, and by the touch, he got his sight back. But not only physical sight, spiritual vision. So he became a preacher. He went to Rome and Turkey and all kinds of, and he was, you know, persecuted himself bitterly, but he was, anyway, he spoke some of the finest verses on love, but this is related to your question. Because he's showing that however greatly powerful, influential, and able you may be in this world, if you don't have love, it's all useless. He said, though I may speak with the empowerment of angels and devas, but have not love, though my words may be very beautiful and poetic, they're no better than the clanging of a gong or the clashing of some cymbals, very unrhythmically. Sometimes it is. Though I may be invested with such powers, is to tell this mountain be thrown into the sea, and it is. But have not love, I have really no ability, no potency. give all that I have in charity, and even relinquish my body to be burned. But I have not love. I haven't really given anything. Love is patient and kind, never jealous, arrogant, or rude. Love believes all things, bears all things, hopes all things, and endures all things, and is, in the end, the only thing we need, because it is the energy of Srimati Radharani which connects us with Krishna. So Shukracharya, back to your question, was very powerful. He didn't have that pure love, so he was envious. And when you're envious, you're also fearful. Because how can one become a bhai? I, Charan, Bhagavinda. There's no other way.
Thank you. You just mentioned about what love is. I just wrote a couple of them. The one you guys brought up about the intention of patience, not jealous.
Well, it was my spontaneous paraphrase of Paul's words, but patient and kind, never arrogant, rude, jealous, harsh, inconsiderate, irrelevant, inappropriate, immature.
This is from my own education. I feel that to progress in our devotional service is very important to open up our hearts to spiritual love, so that
yes.
Let them know the other side of Krishna. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes I feel I'm failing to, you know, express all my bad things, maybe because of my own position, but I don't know how to do it. So I think I'm not, I think I'm giving a wrong picture of myself.
There is no substitute for maturity. Maturity means, I'm not saying we all have to be mature, but we have to progress towards maturity. It means you know how to behave and speak appropriately. And it also means you have a mature understanding. Yes, guru is within the heart. You know, a devotee asked Srila Prabhupada one time, does Gurudev know if I'm not following properly? And Srila Prabhupada said, everybody knows if you're not following properly. It's obvious. The empowerment that comes from properly following the procedure will not be there if you're not following properly. So it's not some big mystical thing to school. No, everybody knows. But the deeper thing is Gurudev knows because Guru is within the heart. So maturity means you know what to express to his external manifestation, what's appropriate as far as what to express. Because there's such a thing in the West called morbid exhibitionism. You just reveal all the ugly things about yourself inappropriately. That's why it's called morbid. So interactions with Gurudev must be very mature, very sober, very cultured, very graceful. It's not like you have to bring up every gory detail. But you have to reveal your heart. It doesn't mean to expose everything within it, because basically we all have the same thing. kama, krodha, lobha, vaha, mada, madhusarya, lust, anger, greed, pride, illusion, envy. Dear Gurudev, I have lust, anger, greed, pride, illusion, and envy. Well, everybody does. Every conditioned soul. It's nothing new. It's nothing unique. And it, you know, doesn't need to be repeated because it's taken for granted. When there's specific challenges that you need some special mercy to overcome, because those special challenges call you to reveal your heart in a way that's going to be pleasing to Gurudev, because it's going to be with the proper etiquette, with the proper culture, the proper question. See, we all want answers, but the questions have to be appropriate. And but also understand that everything we do should be for the pleasure of Gurudev. And therefore, if you're asking something or revealing something that's not appropriate, he's not going to be pleased. So maturity and the counsel of Vaishnavas can help you understand, because all Vaishnavas, to some degree, are guru, they're representatives of guru. So, in our dealings with the Vaishnavas, we learn, you know, what is the proper culture of loving relationships, which determines what I should verbalize and express, and what can go unspoken, but not to be concealed. Like, you know, in a few words, you can actually reveal a lot. So you don't have to go into every gory detail about, you know, the baggage of garbage within your heart. Gurudev basically knows it. When there's specific challenges and issues for which you need some personal guidance that's just not coming from the usual sources, and there will be a question posed with such sincerity, humility, and maturity that Gurudev will be pleased by your straightforwardness. That's the kind of thing you want to reveal.
When Krishna knows, I mean, I think I have more faith in my Sage Master than Krishna. I'm sorry, but
well, first of all, don't try to see Guru without Krishna. Don't try to see Guru without Krishna. Don't try to see Guru without Krishna. Don't try to see Krishna without Guru, because
yeah,
it's representative and the one he represents. They have to be taken in relationship. But our relationship with the ambassador is closer to the sovereign he represents.
Because my is more personal, and I can really see his mercy flowing, and of course even with Krishna, but I think it's only through Maharaj that I can go to Krishna.
Yes.
So I feel it's more important for my Krishna master to go, because if he knows, I just feel Krishna really.
Well, he does know, but it's the act of revealing the heart appropriately. It's one of the forms of loving exchange, but it has to be done in a way that's pleasing, which means the proper maturity, humility, appropriate circumstance and format, and all these things. Another way to look at it is, you know, Gurudev knows basically what's within us. But when there's specific things that would warrant a personal inquiry, and you're relatively sure that his response will be one of pleasure at your presentation, that's the time. And personally reveal, express. Not just, you know, to expose everything that's there to the soul. Basically, he knows that. He doesn't know every detail of every specific challenge that you might be going through at any particular time, and that's the kind of thing where you have the opportunity to converse.
Apart from the sampling, Arnold Whitman, there's a lot of, I think he's given me a lot of other things to progress in my spiritual life. But
yeah.
I'm going to have to say whether it's my own interpretation or not. But I feel like when I was, recently, my spiritual master told me something, I felt that there was so much more that I could learn from the simple answer he gave.
Yeah.
Then I thought maybe I'd go back.
Well, the Vaishnavas will help you. Even if you don't necessarily discuss it with them, you know, if you're, whether your interpretation was right or not, will reveal itself in your dealings with the Vaishnavas. I mean, if you have any question, you can ask, but even if you don't ask, see, if your interpretation is proper, it'll lead you closer to Krishna and closer to harmony with the Vaishnavas. If your interpretation was improper, it's going to lead you more into isolation and illusion and darkness. And you can tell which way you're going. If your interpretation, you know, so that'll... The other thing is, Gurudev doesn't just answer questions. He answers issues in the heart. So yes, one answer may be so rich in significance and meaning that you can just contemplate it forever and derive more and more from it. And that's why Srila Prabhupada said, you know, useless inquiries and absurd questions are condemned. Appropriate questions are welcome and appreciated and uplifted.
Thank you very much for being very wonderful. Every time I have so many questions, I get answered without asking.
The face is the index of the mind, and your face just radiates a list of wonderful questions. And even though I don't know what I'm talking about, your sincerity to hear is so empowering that I will just serve as a mouthpiece for the higher powers.
One question. Like you were telling me, how things are like when you are enjoying this world, then suffering will come in. But like in when we are in this in-between stage of not completely devotional, but like for example, prasadam, we might say the prayers, but maybe it's not. But I like to have that.
Well, let me qualify. It's not that Krishna doesn't want us to enjoy even in this world. There's appropriate enjoyment. But that appropriate enjoyment would be, take for example, appreciating fine prasadam. Oh, this really suits my senses and tongue. Well, you know, that may be. But the kind of appreciation we should cultivate is, this prasadam is so good, it must have pleased Krishna. That's one way. And from the other angle, this prasadam is so good, that devotee who cooked it must have such bhakti that he can appreciate. So it's not that Krishna doesn't want us to, he does want us to enjoy it, but properly, and proper enjoyment, which means, you know, vicarious enjoyment of Krishna's pleasure, that's not sowing the seeds for distress. That's not something you can control or exploit. It's something you can relish, but based on Krishna's pleasure, not your own. As, you know, subordinate and consequent to Krishna's pleasure. That's appropriate. Devotees do enjoy. They should enjoy. They enjoy more than anyone. But it's different because it's based on Krishna's pleasure. Very fun. Must be miserable and tell people join this movement to become like us. You're miserable. Srila Prabhupada was so happy to say that, you know, these devotees are bright faces. It just made him happy. So for Gurudev's pleasure, we should enjoy it, but properly. Not selfishly or exploitatively, in appreciation of how Krishna enjoyed that offering. You always laugh before you ask your question. If you can understand, it's going to be very serious. Bhakti is a devi. Expansion of Shivati Kadra. Who is the personification of the Ladini Shakti. Pleasure giving potency. And that Ladini Shakti is also within the heart of a devotee. How is it that we have any hope of pleasing Krishna? How can an insignificant spark of Krishna's marginal energy, well, of internal energy, but now in the marginal position, give pleasure to he who's Atmaram and Aptakam? It's only because that Ladini Shakti, who is Bhakti Devi, is within our hearts. We have Krishna within our hearts, we also have Bhakti Devi within our hearts. Bhakti Devi produces Krishna. And if we express what's within our hearts, Srimati Radharani takes that off him and gives it to Krishna and says, this devotee is better than me. He's accepted. It's very personal. Science.
I have a question. You spoke about relationships and how envious discussion of relationships. Hare Krishna Prabhu had come some time back, and one point he made was that doing japa purifies the heart, and by doing sankirtan it purifies relationships. Can you throw some light on that? How is it that sankirtan purifies relationships? I didn't understand that point.
Okay, well, we were talking before about the different yuga dharmas. Mm-hmm. Satya yuga, the yuga dharma is meditation. Japa is meditation. You go by the contemplation of holy name, you're going into the depths of your own heart to awaken the bhakti. When the bhakti is awakened a little bit, what do you do? You share it with the devotees by chanting congregationally. You know, development of character requires a certain internal a certain outward development. So, japa is the meditation of the holy name which you contemplate in your heart. The fruit, but that, the fruit is not to go internal. And the individual fruit is loving relationships. The loving relationships necessitate that purification which the japa awards. So they're inseparable. Amongst Mahaprabhu's associates, they were chanting whatever their fixed number of rounds was, but then during the night they were all coming together to dance. According to the fellows of Vrindavan, expressed in the kirtan. And then, that experience is more assimilated by the next morning in japa. So, spiritual advancement is an integration of the internal and outward development, aligning the two with integrity. Japa purifies your heart. Purified heart is essential for purified relationships. But you can also, extend that same principle into, how do you maintain the enthusiasm and quality of relationships, between the times that you come together. Well, reading, we all read or hear Srimad Bhagavatam. And, when you see something, even though you may have read it 1,000 times, but, the book speaks to you in a little different way each time, where, you read something you never read before, or hear something you never heard before, and it just, resonates within your heart. But then you don't do anything with it, it just kind of goes away. Share that with one of our devotees. And then it becomes a realized experience that doesn't go away. It's in the sharing that the realization is perfected. So we get realizations in japa. We get realizations in our personal study of Bhagavatam and Gita. Keep it all to yourself and lock it within your heart. It just kind of goes away. Share it. Very similar principle with japa and sankirtan. When you properly contemplate, through hearing the holy name of japa, you can share realizations, but you can also just share the ecstasy or the whatever, they're coming together. Or it can be separation, but the realization is I don't know if you know the word clinched.
Clinched?
Yeah. It's actually a blacksmith term. Some little blacksmith in this assembly, so. Well, anyway, shoeing horses. When you shoe a horse, you put nails through the shoe and through their hooves. But, if you leave it at that, it's just going to fall off. So after you get all the nails in, you bend the nail back over. It goes through the hoof and then it bends over, so it can't pull out. So it's there to stay. So, clench means, done. It's there to stay. So, what you experience in japa and your individual study of scripture, it's not really, I can't think of another word to clinch, it's really, it's when you share it. Mm-hmm. All we always chanting my glories, conversing about me. The Buddhist guru derives great satisfaction in this. So what does that mean? Always chanting my glories? That can be individual. Conversing about me, that means relationships. Endeavoring with great determination. Always derive great satisfaction in this. There's no enjoyment in any individual endeavor. So as you were saying, it's not that we're against pleasure or enjoyment. We are, if it's sanctified, if it's appropriate, if it's spiritual. But there's no pleasure in solitary devotion. And it's not that we're either, you know, it's not that we're averse to pleasure, it's not that we're after pleasure. We're after Krishna's pleasure, but what's pleasing to Krishna is harmonious relationships. That necessitates the purification of the individual heart. That's the japa. The fruit of that, the fulfillment of that, and that which, you know, really gives it substance and sustainability is the kirtan. Come together in association to voice. To share the experience of singing and dancing congregation.
I was trying to contemplate on this Krishna's name and the form of multiple from each other, and it seems like it's kind of a mental adjustment, at least until now. My question is, how to realize that Krishna's name and form?
By chanting Krishna's name. But theoretically, there's some things that, you know, like we were discussing how the demigods' power there. We call them airplanes, but they're really not going through the air, they're really going through space, but we call them airplanes. Powered by mantra, because, you know, higher beings have the ability to extract subtle power. Like, you know, what happened, which ended World War II, you know, the German scientists studied how to for the Americans, studied how to extract power from the atom in the atomic bomb. A little thing. As big as a football. Someone shocked Japanese and Germans. They called off the war. We can't deal with this. Throwing energy out of the atom. That's gross. Subtle energies are much more powerful. The power within a mantra. So what's mantra? It means, you know, that sound vibration that delivers the mind from its delusion. Okay, well, mantra is, you know, consists of Sanskrit characters. Charita. There's the vowels and the consonants. The vowels are the male entities of nature. The consonants are the female, and therefore they can't be alone. They have to have the male. And then you have the Devanagari script. Is that just some arbitrary language that somebody made up? No, it's a science. That's the impression of those characters.